happening, an arbitrariness that liberals should be spotlighting. Trump's spat with Canada is particularly illogical. His supposed concerns about fentanyl and migration are surely not the explanation, since a minuscule amount of fentanyl and exceedingly few illegal migrants cross the border to the U.S. So why is Trump bent on a trade war with Canada? Personal pique over Canada's refusal to sell itself to the U.S.? Whatever the reason, these latest tariffs will cause Wisconsin dairy farmers dearly and the U.S. home building industry dearly, just as the auto tariffs will eventually cost Michigan dearly. That hardly squares with putting America first. We can say in explanation of Donald Trump's behavior that he lacks empathy, has no guardrails, is unpredictable, is mean-spirited, or simply has bad judgment. But the bottom line is simpler. He's a stupid man. A clever propagandist, yes. A cunning negotiator, yes. But ignorance is at the heart of the matter. Martin Luther King is supposed to have said, "Nothing in the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance or conscientious stupidity." No one fits that description better than Donald Trump. He never took advantage of his privileged youth to educate himself about how the world beyond the super wealthy lives, or about the nationalism that frames other countries' perspectives. We see how, as president, he leads an insulated life. Very few trips abroad, and certainly not to developing countries. No welcoming parties for Africans or Latin Americans. No interest in other countries' music, art, or literature. He's about to preside over the closure of numerous U.S. embassies and consulates abroad, mainly in Europe, because in his judgment, saving money is more important than having outposts to monitor and report on developments and serve foreigners interested in the U.S. or hoping to travel here. He, and Elon Musk as well, are deaf to any purpose other than personal gain. America has never had such a poor and dangerous representative of who we are or hope to be. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Doug McVeigh, Dave Johnson, Mel Gertoff, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, Judith Ruiz Branch, Suzanne Potter, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
This is Dr. Demento, and you are listening to the KBOO News, the only news you need.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Dave Johnson. In light of the recent arrest of Palestinian and Columbia University activist Mahmoud Khalil, the escalated fear of deportation rocked immigrant communities across the nation and the state of Oregon. ICE arrests and detentions slowed in recent weeks after a fast start in the early days of Trump's return to the White House. Local activists with the Multnomah Village chapter of the national activist organization Indivisible encourage everyone across the state. Oregon is one of 13 sanctuary states, and in July of 1987, Oregon became the very first sanctuary state in the nation. I sat down with two principal activists in the local Indivisible chapter to discuss how Oregon's sanctuary promise can work to protect members of marginalized communities by prioritizing human rights, dignity, and safety. We're joined today by Kathy Spofford and Eileen Frommer of the Multnomah Village chapter of Indivisible. To give us some background on their organization, we're going to talk about the deportation threat of undocumented immigrants. Welcome, Kathy and Eileen. First off, tell me about Indivisible. What is it?
We are part of Indivisible, which is a nationwide movement of thousands of volunteer-led local groups that engage in progressive advocacy and electoral work at the local, state, and national level. We are committed to stopping MAGA extremists and returning democracy to the U.S. through work on city, county, state, and federal legislation. Core topics include climate, the environment, and social justice. We promote progressive values and model inclusion, respect, fairness, truthfulness, and nonviolence in our actions.
It feels like we're in the middle of an autocratic power grab that renders Congress, state government, local elected officials, and voters powerless to act against the Trump administration. As you understand the scale of the threat to undocumented immigrants in our state, how will Indivisible fight back?
Indivisible will fight back by educating ourselves and other people about how we can help immigrants and what their rights are. So we'll be hosting some workshops where people will learn what their rights are, and we'll also be learning from the Department of Justice and the ACLU about how we can protect our spaces, our safe spaces, schools, churches, hospitals.
On February 24th, you hosted an advocate from the Oregon Department of Justice to share details on ODOJ's sanctuary promise. What did you learn?
Well, we learned that in Oregon, our local law enforcement cannot help ICE in any of their deportation activities. But we also learned that we really can't stop them from doing their job. There are safe places, but a lot of that safety has been rescinded by the Trump administration. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now about where people can be safe, where ICE can go, and how they can gain access.
What are the protected areas, the safe areas that you're talking about?
Well, there have always been safe areas, courthouses, schools, clinics, churches. Many of those safety areas have been impacted by this rescind order, where the government is now saying that ICE can go into those areas. The one caveat is if an area is marked as private, then they cannot go in unless they have a judicial warrant, and that's a warrant signed by a judge.
Now, as I understand it, there are public spaces in most areas, like a church or a school. How does the ODOJ define that safe area within a public space like a church or a school or a hospital?
Well, a church would have to put up signs that say the fellowship hall or the offices are private areas. They'd have to have a signage that says this is a private area. The sanctuary would not be a private area since it's open to the public.
One of the things that I learned about from the ODOJ, Oregon Department of Justice, is that Oregon is a sanctuary state. Can you give us some background on what that means?
Well, as a sanctuary state, our local resources and law enforcement cannot aid ICE. We don't stand in their way, but they would not help them to enter a building or to arrest someone.
What about giving details?
They cannot give details. Even when they're on duty or off duty, they can't share information about people.
Excuse me. So if there's an off-duty police officer, that person is not able to off-duty have a beverage and share that with ICE or any other government authority.
No, that would be a violation of the sanctuary law. Do you have something?
I think the only other thing I would add to that is that I think we have had our sanctuary law since the 80s. I remember if it was 1980 or exactly what year, but we've had it since the 80s, and we were the first state in the country to have a sanctuary law.
So how do we prepare for encounters with ICE or other federal immigration authorities?
Well, we have to educate ourselves about what our rights are, what the rights of undocumented people are, and know where and when they can enter. They need to have a judicial warrant signed by a judge. If they have just an administrative warrant that ICE can issue, that's not adequate to come into a building or to go into someone's home and detain them. So we can also publicize the website at the DOJ, the Sanctuary Promise website, which is sanctuarypromise.oregon.gov. There are also some hotlines that people call if they are approached by ICE or they have concerns. The number is 844-924-7829. There is a Spanish-only line, 844-626-7276. And there's relay in 240 languages.
That was Kathy Spofford and Eileen Frommer with the Multnomah Village chapter of Indivisible. Here are those telephone numbers and the website one more time. You can find details on the Sanctuary Promise Community Toolkit through the Oregon Department of Justice Civil Rights Unit website. That's doj.state.or.us. Sanctuary Promise Violations Hotline is 1-844-924-STAY or 7829. The Spanish direct line is 1-844-626-7276. They offer interpreters in 240 languages and accept TTY relay calls as well. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Dave Johnson.
are listening to KBOO News In Depth. Students and professors expressing solidarity with the Palestinian cause have been having a tough time on many U.S. college campuses since the Israel-Hamas war started in October 2023. And now it looks like things may be getting worse for them. In January, for instance, President Trump signed an executive order calling for immediate action against non-citizen college students who engage in pro-Palestine protests. And there's been actions taken against students and faculty members who are citizens, too. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Jonah Rubin, the senior manager for campus organizing for Jewish Voice for Peace, about the campus repression that's come down against those advocating for Palestinian rights, as well as those involved in other protests.
When I hear about the stuff that's going on campuses in terms of cracking down on pro-Palestinian protests, it seems almost a little nutty to me. I mean, that people wearing keffiyehs would be suspected of anti-Semitism, or that any sort of speaking out for Palestinian rights would be considered an assault on the Jewish people. Is that the impression you get?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that we are living in a time when the U.S. government has decided to target some of the most vulnerable populations as part of its attempt to implement a broad far-right agenda. And one of those vulnerable populations that it is targeting are Palestinian students and their allies in the Palestine Solidarity Movement as a way of opening up attacks on the entire movement for social justice.
But during the Biden administration, this was going on as well, right? And they weren't a far-right government. They were just extremely pro-Israel.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think this is really important, that the repression that we're seeing right now began under the Biden administration and has intensified under the Trump administration. So what we're seeing is not entirely new, but it is intensifying in worrying ways. And some of the most worrying ways are in the ways that the administration has recruited universities to do its dirty work that it's not willing to do itself.
What do you mean by that? What sort of dirty work?
So let me give you an example. The executive order that Trump signed on January 29th targeting non-citizen students who engage in pro-Palestine activism got a lot of coverage, rightly so, for its threats to students who engage in political organizing. But it didn't actually grant ICE or DHS or any federal authority any kinds of new powers. Instead, what it did was instruct the Department of Education, the Health and Human Services Department, and the Department of Justice to speak to universities and to get them to do these types of harsh disciplinary practices against their own students, faculty, and staff who are engaged in basic human rights activism. So let me just give you one or two examples if I can. At NYU, we saw the administration ban professors from teaching in their own classrooms because of their engagement with nonviolent protests outside of the campus library. At Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh, we saw students and the Students for Justice in Palestine Club threatened with suspension for silently studying in their own library, wearing keffiyehs with signs saying Free Palestine. I mean, just imagine universities targeting their own students, their own faculty, their own staff for studying in a library. That's the kind of thing that we're seeing right now. They're going far beyond what they're required to by law, far beyond what they're required to by the threats of funding, to do what's being called anticipatory compliance, to be the harsh end of repression in the vain hope that somehow, if they target Palestine enough, universities will be spared. But we have Project 2025, we have Project Esther, we know that they're coming after universities. And so what we at Jewish Voice for Peace are saying is that universities right now have to stand up for their core values, for their core educational mission, for the presence of international students, faculty, and staff on their campus, and push back hard against these attempts to get rid of dissent, to get rid of international students, to get rid of undocumented students on their campuses.
And you'd think that these kind of attacks would be considered outrageous and a violation of academic freedom. And then you have professors who are tenured and the idea that you're going to tell them what they can and can't teach in their classroom, I think that would make people quite angry.
They certainly are attacks on core academic freedoms. And we're seeing groups like the American Association of University Professors really step up to the plate and push back hard against universities that are violating professors' rights to teach what they want to in the classroom. That's not even enough for so many of these universities. At Muhlenberg College, they fired Professor Maura Finkelstein for reposting the words of a Palestinian poet on her personal Instagram. I think it would be appropriate to teach the words of this Palestinian poet in the classroom themselves. They didn't even care what she did in the classroom. They fired her for personal Instagram posts that wasn't claiming to represent the university or anything. They really see any expression of Palestinian culture, of Palestinian solidarity, of Palestinian identity as somehow a threat and as something that they need to repress. I mean, to the point where the Health and Human Services Department launched investigations into four medical schools because students at the graduation of those medical schools were wearing keffiyehs and Palestinian flags on their graduation regalia. Simple expressions of Palestinian identity, of Palestinian culture, are being criminalized by this administration with the willing compliance of way too many university administrators who should know better and who need to stand up right now for what it means to be a university.
Are there universities around the country that are standing up to this or who are just not complying?
Far too few. I would point to Bowdoin and their reaction to the recent encampment there that students led. We don't fully know yet everything that's going to shake out there. There are still disciplinary procedures against eight of the students who were the center of this encampment. Their posture towards their students, certainly supported by quite a number of faculty and alumni who've been really key stepping up here, has been recognizing that they are fulfilling the aspirations of that particular institution towards working for citizenship and towards social justice. I am heartened quite a bit by the work of the AAUP and of faculty unions and graduate student unions who recognize that this is a threat to all of their members, that once you establish the precedent that politicians can tell you what you can and can't teach in your classroom, that's a threat to what it means to be a professor. That's a threat to what it means to be a university. So some of the best pushback I think we've seen has come from professional associations and from unions.
You mentioned the idea of setting a precedent, and I'm wondering if some of these universities are going to use the sort of playbook they're using to crack down on pro-Palestinian solidarity, if they're going to use that against other sorts of protests.
We don't have to guess at that. They already are. At the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, there's been a student environmental group that has protested for 10 years asking their university to divest from fossil fuels. Personally, I think it's ridiculous that they've had to protest 10 years to tell their university to stop polluting their future, to make their planet livable for when they're adults. But, you know, this protest has been going on for 10 years every single week. And all of a sudden, UIUC, after they passed a series of draconian protest restrictions that were designed to repress Palestine solidarity movements, they've applied it to this group now, too. And so their environmental protest is now banned on campus, and students are being disciplined for engaging in the same protest that they've done for 10 years. So we know that this is not just about Palestine solidarity, that this is about coming after trans rights activists, queer rights activists, environmental activists, racial justice activists, reproductive rights activists, and anybody else who has a vision of social justice and inclusivity for the future.
Any push coming from state legislatures or Congress about this?
Yes. So we've seen Congress continue to try to crack down on campuses, to crack down on professors, to crack down on student protesters. Just the other day, we saw the Department of Education, Congressional Committee on Education issue a subpoena to Columbia asking for disciplinary records. We think it sets a really worrisome precedent of a fishing exercise. And so one of the things that we have asked universities to do is to destroy any disciplinary records that they have for student protesters, whether that's related to immigrant justice work, Palestine solidarity work, or any other social justice work. It's fully in the rights of a university to destroy this paperwork. We know that this is a basic measure that universities can do to increase the security of their students at a time when Congress and state legislators are going on fishing expeditions to try to hoover up these documents and find one sentence that they can take out of context in order to revoke funding for the university.
Any pushback the other way from, say, the Progressive Caucus in Congress or any progressives in state legislatures who want to put a stop to this kind of repression?
Yes, absolutely. We've been seeing more and more legislators, thanks to the really strong organizing across the board, recognize the threat of things like the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism, a definition that intentionally conflates anti-Zionism and harsh criticism of Israeli human rights violations with anti-Semitism. Last year, we saw a number of congresspeople move from supporting the first reading of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, a bill that would have enshrined IHRA into U.S. law, move on the second vote after massive mobilizations, after massive call-ins, after they started to understand what this definition would mean for the ability of students, faculty, and staff to fulfill their basic functions. We saw a lot of them flip and start to oppose it. And so there's a lot to fight for here. And a lot of state legislatures and a lot of Congress and the Senate, there are movable decision makers who need to be made to understand the consequences of their actions right now and how something that is seemingly good, I mean, who doesn't oppose anti-Semitism, is being used to shut down the movement, being used to shut down basic activism and basic advocacy for human rights.
And anything else you want to add to what you said?
Yeah, you know, so much of this is being done in the name of Jewish safety. And it's laughable that this is coming out of people who not only do not have Jewish safety in mind themselves, but are themselves organized around the principles of Christian Zionism. So we're seeing this come from an administration that has Sebastian Gorka, who's linked to all sorts of Nazi organizations, Elon Musk, who gave the Nazi salute in front of the presidential seal twice, Darren Beatty, who is a frequent speaker at white supremacist events, Kash Patel's FBI director, who has a tendency to go on Holocaust denier podcasts. These are not people who have any right to talk about Jewish safety, and they're not people who are interested in Jewish safety. These are people who are interested in advancing their Christian Zionist project, who are advancing Christian nationalism and authoritarianism at home, and who are using the language of Jewish safety to advance their own far-right agendas. And so at this moment, it's really crucial for us to be pushing back and saying, not in our name, that we are here as Jews. We have poll after poll showing the majority of Jews do not support these policies, and that we need to be standing up opposing it. We need to be putting pressure on university administrators. We need to be organizing at every level across the board to push back on this authoritarian policy.
Do you see this as a kind of new McCarthyism or something worse?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a new McCarthyism. We've seen students expelled. We've seen faculty fired. We've seen contractors lose their jobs because they're not willing to toe the line, because they're willing to listen to experts in the field. They're willing to listen to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch that declare that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. They're willing to listen to Israeli human rights organizations like B'Tselem, Palestinian human rights organizations like Al-Haq that note the apartheid system in Israel. And because they're not willing to abandon the truth, they're losing out on their careers, on their ability to complete their education, their scholarship, their ability to earn a living, because they're not willing to lie, because they're not willing to abandon the truth. We know in the long run that these attempts to clamp down in the movement, these attempts at censorship, these attempts to combat people pursuing the good, the right, the social justice are going to fail. How long that long term is up to all of us. And so that's why we need to get together and organize.
That was Jonah Rubin from Jewish Voice for Peace speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds